We are in the longest chapter of the book, Esther chapter 10, as has been pointed out. We're going to go through I'm going to give you a quiz here in a minute. So it's not a Daniel quiz, though. He's not even in here to defend himself, so I'll stop there. But we'll talk a bit about the things that have happened so far. As a way of jumping in, though, here we've seen Esther save the Jewish nation by going before the king and requesting his permission to have the Jews defend themselves. They defend themselves, and lots of people die, bloodshed. The war this week makes us realize what the reality of people dying looks like, and it did seem to add an element to this book that the Jews went in and killed people, and that really happened. There was really bloodshed, and this was not just four verses in a old writing of something. This was a war. This was an event that had serious consequences and serious elements, and they were rejoicing at the end, this day of Purim that we studied about on Wednesday night. What was salvation coming to them and them being able to celebrate that. And so as we come to the end of the book in chapter 10, we'll read here these three verses. And King Ahasuerus imposed tribute to the land and on the island and on the islands of the sea. Now all the acts of his power and his might and the account of the greatness of Mordecai, to which the king advanced him, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the kings of Media and Persia? For Mordecai the Jew was second to King Ahasuerus, and was great among the Jews, and well received by the multitudes of his brethren, seeking the good of his people, and speaking peace to all his countrymen. So what do we see here? It's an interesting verse here in verse 1. It switches gears and says what? Ahasuerus taxed the people. There's a narrative we've talked about with this war in Greece that he lost, and that this offer of Haman was very appealing because it was an opportunity to recoup some of the lost costs of a lost war. And maybe there's something to do with that here, but clearly it's stating the power that Ahasuerus has. And why is that important in the context of the rest of these verses?
Implemented with the assistance of Mordecai?
I think Mordecai was definitely there to help assist with this. That's true. Maybe a step further is it shows the power that Mordecai had as his second in command, right? To show the power of Ahasuerus is really to show the power that Mordecai had as second in command. This is not some king that occupied 30 acres and Mordecai, who was second in command over this. This was over all of these territories from Asia into this, the Middle East down to Egypt, into Northern Africa, and Mordecai was second in command over all that. And that just gives you some of the weight of his role in the empire. And we see in verse 3 some of the weight he has among the Jewish people, and what's their impression of Mordecai at the end of all this? He's popular among his kinsmen, right? And to the sense that he sought peace and he brought the good of his people. We talked a little bit about the fact that the Israelites didn't plunder any of the resources. Do you think that this verse suggests Mordecai had something to do with that? Mordecai was not a man of war. Mordecai was not a man of looting and plunder. He sought the peace and the good of the people. And the fact that they followed through with this very wise decision not to plunder their enemies, I think maybe we see Mordecai's influence retroactively in this verse. Any other thoughts as we wrapped up these three verses? Yeah, Brian.
I see a parallel of Joseph and Egypt. We got two situations where the predecessors to the Jewish nation are in a foreign land of Egypt, and Joseph rises, who is in prison, rises to second in command and blesses the Jewish people. And now you see Mordecai with the sentence of death on his head rising to second in command as well and blesses the Jewish people.
Yeah, it's hard not to call out on those allusions to stories like particularly Joseph. I've thought of that several times, but particularly because Mordecai himself calls that out to Esther in the book. Good point. Yeah, Dustin.
So I think this is also a good place to look at the influence that Mordecai has on Ahasuerus. Mm-hmm. Because when you go back to the beginning, when we first opened the book, Ahasuerus is in a drinking party with Haman as his number two. He doesn't care about what's going on in his kingdom. He's very unaware of the law that Haman passes, a very passive role for a leader of a people. And yet, as we close the book with Mordecai as his number two, now he's active in his kingdom. He's imposing taxes. It seems that he's much more attentive to the things that are happening in his realm now than he was at the beginning. So I think that's a good just kind of lesson to take from this, as you know, the people you surround yourself with makes a big difference as to how you conduct yourself.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about those bookends, but it's a great thought. Yeah, Mike.
So right now the Jews have got to be feeling pretty good about themselves. I mean, they overcame and killed a bunch of folks that were under Ahasuerus' reign. Mordecai is beloved by all of them, way up in the ranks. But right here at the end is kind of showing Ahasuerus is still saying, I'm the boss, you know, and you still, even though you've done a lot of good things, Mordecai's done a good things, he's done them all under my direction, and I'm still the boss of this.
Yeah.
So I see that he's kind of reasserting his overall power here, so there's no mistake about where he fits in the kingdom.
For sure. Yeah, one more comment back there from Robert. It doesn't have to be the last one. We only have three verses. No.
Yeah, I'm just reflecting on, maybe we haven't gotten to it yet, but you know, the fact that they keep emphasizing Mordecai as the second to the king. Why do we not talk more about Mordecai? Because we talk a whole bunch about Daniel. Daniel was second to the king.
Yeah. Well, I think we mentioned it in another class. There are some versions of this copy throughout the years that have been the book of Mordecai. To your point, that is not an uncommon thought, at least in the realm of historical writings. But any good thinking there? Anything else here? All right. Well, since Bill only gave me three verses, he did offer to talk us through some providence. I'll let him come up here. Oh, he's not ready for that. Okay. I'm so funny. Sorry, guys. Trying to loosen y'all up a little bit. It's a little stiff in here. No, Bill wasn't having any of it. So let's spend a few minutes. Let's spend a few minutes looking at this quiz. There's multiple answers. Some of the things we've already kind of hit on, which is good. These aren't really meant to be right or wrong. Did you learn the lessons? But open up a dialogue about the book. So we'll spend about, I don't know, 7 or 8 minutes here filling out these quizzes. Try to find some verses to support your thoughts, and we'll have a hopefully a good dialogue about the whole of the book. And That may launch us into some texts I have prepared on providence if we get to that point. So take a few minutes, look through this, and see what you come up with. Some of these are just to get you to think about some of the topics we've talked through. Some of them are kind of to provoke discussion. but we talked a little bit about this at the beginning, that this is not the middle school story that we tell our kids. And I think there's a couple of things to unpack from that. But either this particular study for me when we did it in the back classroom was one of the first times I'd really taken a hard look at Esther in the last 15 or 20, basically since I've been an adult. And so for me, the reality, the gravity of the situations we found was particularly heavier than I would have remembered. But I wondered if you had any similar thoughts or what stood out to you as you studied this since you were an adolescent. Yeah, Brian.
Well, some of the things that I had not thought about in a long time is the number of repeated acts of God's providence that are spread throughout the book of Esther. Secondly, I didn't realize that God was not mentioned by name in all of the book, which I was a sort of a revelation to me. And also, the complicity of Mordecai and Esther's submission to the process of her becoming queen, which is quite immoral.
Yeah, a raw part of the story for sure. Yeah, Jordan.
To me, it's not quite as black and white as maybe you and I remembered it growing up. Mm-hmm. In terms of, hey, there's a clear hero, there's a clear villain and whatnot. I mean, I think we can draw some of that. But to me, that means it's there's a lot more gray than what I had probably remembered or anticipated. I guess it's another question about the character of Mordecai. I think there's some questionable things in there as well. Anyway, that was just my...
Yeah. Certainly, I think I mentioned this a few weeks ago, but my daughter has a book that makes this very G-rated, and it is very black and white, and that maybe is not the real story here. Yeah, Justin.
One thing that I had never really spent much time thinking about was the potential implications that this story and this event had on the Jewish culture moving forward for the next several hundred years.
Yeah, for sure. It was well celebrated and is to this day. Anything else? Yeah, Michael.
I never knew that or connected that Ahasuerus was like most likely the same person as Xerxes.
Oh, yeah, that's a cool real-world fact there. Yeah, Chris.
So I didn't learn anything in middle school because I didn't go to church, but one of the things I find interesting is that, especially in the climate of today and the pandemic and so forth, I'm realizing that this young woman who already lost all her family, had to live with a distant relative, basically, then had to go before a king who wanted a wife because his other wife didn't obey. She lost her status as a person just because she went in front of him. And all these factors, she had to be obedient, she had to listen, she had to do whatever was said of her because of these selfish individuals. Our life is no different than that today. And yet God's hand is in it, mm-hmm. no matter what, and no matter what's at stake in your life. And I think we tend to forget that and get so bombarded by just mess.
Yeah, absolutely. Great thoughts. Over here? Or?
Yeah. The thing that stuck out to me, the Bible tells us in Romans 15, verse 4, that the things that are written down for us are written for our learning, and that we need to have patience and comfort in the Scriptures. And I see the patience in Esther when she was asked to step over the line and risk her life, mm-hmm. that she stopped. She said, me and my maidens will pray and fast for 3 days, and I want the rest of the Jews in the country to do that. And then when she started her process, she started very slowly and methodically and made sure that it was, you know, done in that fashion. And I have trouble with that.
Sure.
I want to do things. I'm an engineer, and I want to do things quickly and efficient and get started. And a lot of times I wished I'd thought things through a little bit more and said stuff in a way that was clear. A lot of times I say stuff and it's it's not too clear to those that hear it, and it's misinterpreted.
That's right.
And I think that's a good thing for us to learn to be.
I can identify with
that. Scripture, not jump ahead, and to be patient with when we teach others, when we share the word, that we do it in a patient attitude, not quickly and to get things over with.
All really great lessons learned. One more, Robert. Every time I point at Robert, I say one more.
I'm not convinced. I don't have any. It's a feeling, but maybe as you think about the image of gold that Daniel saw, that this is God's hand in ensuring that Persia played the role that it needed to in order to prepare the way for Jesus to be able to come on the scene when he did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Good points. Just the life and death gravity here is a lot heavier to me than I think I would have absorbed. I mean, from the point of her contest to the annihilation of the Jews, this was all really heavy subject matter. But let's go on to the next question. And I don't mean to be provocative with this question. I've thought a lot about this, though, particularly the last 6 weeks in this session. And that is to say, what does the Bible highlight about the righteousness of the righteous level of a Jew that Mordecai saw? So maybe tell us what you ranked on the scale. I don't think there's a right or wrong answer. But why you think that from the verses? Yeah, Ian.
Okay, here we go.
Okay.
If I had to rank him first, I'd probably say he's somewhere in the middle, 5 or 6. And I'll give you my reasons why. So we know that there's some laws laid out about taking care of family when a father or a husband passes away. We don't know enough background about Esther and her and the family she came from. Was she an orphan? Did she come from a family that had a great inheritance? Mm-hmm. You know, like, were there motivating factors for Mordecai to step in? Or was he the only person to step in and he just did what he should have done? So there's a lot that we don't know, but we know that he knew the law to some extent because he stepped in as a father. We see that in chapter 2, verse 7. We see in chapter 3, verse 2, that he did not bow down. So there's like ingrained in him some faith and some belief in Jewish law and in God himself. And then in 4, verse 1, I don't really have this fully fleshed out, but he tore his clothes and put sackcloth to ashes, which is kind of copying what David did when he was mourning Abner. So he knows some little nuanced type things about scripture and what's happening. So I would probably say he's average, but if we had a little more context, we could go one way or the other. But at least he is attempting to do what's right in accordance to Jewish history, Jewish law, that sort of thing.
Let's hold on to that idea of a little more context and let a few more people comment. We're going to come back to that. I think that's really important here. Anybody else similar, different? Yeah, Michael.
I gave him a 7.
7.
A good score. But probably because I'm just forgetting the strikes against him. So I'll be glad to hear those who had him lower if they did. But along with what Ian said, I'm remembering the talk he had with Esther about, like, you know, who knows, maybe you were put in this position, you know, kind of to save your people talk, you know, like implying, you know, like maybe, you know, it's showing some faith that God put you here for a reason, kind of that talk, you know, and using that to influence and encourage Esther to try to act mm-hmm. for the Jewish people. I think that's to do that is an act of faith. And he showed loyalty to the Jewish people. And then the whole not plundering thing, I guess you could throw that in there,
yeah,
as you mentioned.
I think that's a good one.
So those were the, I don't know if I'm right about it. You know, there's a lot of interpretation in Esther because there's so much not said. Mm-hmm. But I think sometimes maybe he could have, I don't know, maybe the way I see it, he could have maybe had better self-control around Haman, you know, like played that differently or more smartly. I don't know. I wasn't there, right? So, but that's all I have, aside from what Ian said.
Good thoughts. Anyone else want to take a run at this? I mean, I think we've hit the major themes, right? I mean, he knew enough about the law to push Esther to act in faith. But clearly there were some things that are at best questionable. And I guess what I want us to focus on is this is not a story in the context in what we have written about Esther and Mordecai's righteousness, right? That is not the story that we have written, which I think makes it more beautiful, right? What is it a story of then? Were they saved because of Esther's great goodness? No.
It's
sovereignty of God.
Yeah, it's a story of God executing his plan even through seemingly normal people.
Yeah.
Flawed people.
All right. We hit on this when we went through some of this early on. Isaiah 55:13. Remember, Esther's name means myrtle. Isaiah 55:13. Instead of the thorn shall come of the cypress tree, and instead of the briar shall come up a myrtle. And that's exactly what you're saying is God saved despite the people he was working with. Is there ever a case in the Old Testament where that's not true? I mean, think about it. We got some really good people like Daniel. Did Daniel save the Jewish nation? God, well, but that wasn't the story of Daniel. It was personal. When we come to these stories of great salvation, macro salvation, it is always God doing it in spite of the thorns and the briars and the people that are involved. And I really think that hones in at why there's no context. I can't say whether he was super righteous or not. There's just not enough evidence here to suggest that. I have a feeling, but that's all it is. The story, though, is God providing despite the people working with. Yeah, Terry and then Jordan.
I was just going to comment on God's providence through this, and it really goes back even to Exodus, because Haman was an Agite, and that's who fought against the Jews when Moses had to have his hands raised on the hill, the Amalekites. And God had Moses to write that he had utterly destroyed that nation that name from off the face of the earth. So, you know, we have God still dealing with maybe the last of the Amalekites in Haman.
Right.
Because he had his 10 sons killed also.
Yeah, that could very well be.
What's all that's worth, but it is an interesting story that goes back into Exodus with those.
I hadn't thought too much about that, but that's an interesting point. At Jordan.
That's a good point Terry just made, though. So myself, maybe I held Mordecai maybe in a lesser extent, maybe than what the comments we've been making or whatnot. But I think the point is what you said, John, is so accurate. Is what did this prove? What did this show? This was preserving God's people, and we don't have to look too far back to look at Judges and found some pretty shady characters. What was the whole objective of those stories? Was preserving God's people. And so yeah, I think your point's accurate that, you know, in spite of flaws and issues and unrighteousness, God's plan is always progressing and moving at the way in which he wants it to be done. And how is it any different for us today?
Yeah, exactly. Albert.
If you have time, just,
no, please.
I think it's interesting you chose the word devout as opposed to faithfulness and or righteousness like you just talked about. You know, devout, looking it up, and it was having or showing deep religious feeling or commitment. Totally committed to a cause or belief. So by you choosing devout, I pegged them way high on the scale. And I look at caring for the people and calling upon Esther to do what needed to be done and not plundering. And it wasn't a matter of self-defense. I remember Esther saying, that if we had just been sold into slavery, I'd be good, but they're actually were being sold to be killed.
That's right.
So it's just they see their role and the purpose. We are captive. We're willing to be slaves, and just but it is going to be preserving of God's people. So
good thoughts. Really, this time on this question, last one for Robert.
Romans 13, verse 1 and following comes to mind. Let every soul be subject to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God, and the authorities that exist are appointed by God. But then it talks about the role of the mm-hmm. of the king, well, kingdoms of men, but the kingdom, so that what they're there to do. I think that in order to underlie that, you can point right back to Daniel, you can point right back to Mordecai and Esther and say, look, Romans 13 is true and just, let me show you why.
Mm-hmm. Yep, excellent tie in there. Let's go through this one fast. One words on Esther, shout them out, I'll repeat them. Compassionate, brave, oh gosh, yes. Contemplative, thoughtful, she planned. What was that? Loving. God-loving. Yes, God-loving. I'll take it. Patient. She took her time. Yeah, Greg talked a lot about that a few minutes ago, right? I think that's spot on. What are the three signs of obedience that really help us? Well, there's not three, but if you were to pick three, that help us know that this, they were tuning in to the Old Testament, the Old Law, and trying to obey what God had said. Yeah, Justin.
Maybe I misunderstood the question. Is this? Are you now talking about the people in the book or Esther?
Esther and Mordecai, okay, more or okay. less. But anyone who did.
I read it as Esther, the character, for this question as well. So the three that I listed were her obedience and respect to Mordecai, who was like a father figure to her, her faithfulness and respect to her husband, the king, and her loyalty and concern for her people.
Love it. Great summary. Yeah, Brian.
Even though God's name's not mentioned, you see Esther's faith in God in that she instructs the Jews to fast, and which is always an act of submission to God, and is accompanied with prayer. And of course, she and her maidens also fasted.
Yeah, appealing to God's grace and love. Absolutely. Anything else? Yeah, Dustin.
The one verse that I would pick out is from chapter 4, where Mordecai tells Esther, if you don't do something to deliver the Jewish people, they will still be delivered in another way.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that's spot on, right? The fact that she puts herself out there to save her people, she sacrifices herself three times. We see the scepter have to be put out. She sacrifices herself for her people. And if there's no greater type of Christ love shown, it's to sacrifice yourself. And that's exactly right. She's showing God's love through this action. Robert? I didn't say it.
Esther 4:16, fasting. And then there's another verse where she says, pray for me. Get all the people to pray for me.
Yep. Good thoughts there. So we do see people following God's law. Despite everything we've said, God's law is followed in the book. And God shows his faithfulness how? I think Brian touched on this, right? This is the providence. What are the acts of providence we see in the book? Preservation, but how? Like what happens in the book? The king couldn't sleep. And the Chronicles just happened to open up.
One moment.
That's right. On the right night. And who was outside waiting? Haman. Yeah, that's a good one.
I always thought it had been interesting if the reason the king couldn't sleep was because Mordecai was building a gallows to keep him awake.
I like, if you didn't hear that, the Haman was having this construction project right outside the window. And Ahasuerus couldn't. I like that. O'Brien.
God positioned Mordecai to detect the plot against the king, which then is associated with the king reading the Chronicles.
That's right.
Of course, God positioned Esther to save her people, his people.
Yep, to the verse in chapter 4, the fact that Esther was the queen at all had a lot to do with the story. Yeah, Mike. Yeah. Was Robert's hand up?
Also, I think back in chapter 3, verse 6, where it's talking about regardless of how angry Haman was at Mordecai, that he did not lay a hand on him. And we've seen other places that, you know, God has said, do what you want to, but don't lay a hand on him. And that's basically what I see coming out in this.
Haman would have been a lot better off if he just dealt with Haman. And, Robert?
So Esther 10 to Mordecai is actually in the place where he needs to be able to write the law to defend the Jews against the atrocities coming.
Yeah. Ian?
Thinking about the first shall be last and the last shall be first, there's several examples of where the Jewish people were, I mean, they're killing them off, right? They're taking everything from them. They're last, lowest on the totem pole. And then at the end, you know, Haman falls and bows basically to Esther pleading. The roles are reversed and the Jewish people are uplifted and glorified in the end. So it's just like,
yep.
That's providence to me.
So y'all missed one. Let's move to the back page here. Point being, lots of little things, right? We see it all throughout the book. But there's one big one to me, and that is the whole name that the feast is celebrated afterwards by. And what is that word? Do we remember? Purim, because that means casting lots. Why is that relevant to, why is that the name of the feast? That's how they made decisions. And what decision was made? When to destroy those Jews? And was it the next 3 days? It was 10 months later. I mean, there is a huge act of providence that I think just by Mordecai naming the feast Purim that is called out here, right? And that's not because they happened to throw dye. That's because God's hand was involved in that, and that's where we see the providence coming out, and that the dye was cast in such a way that the story could unfold in the way it did. And it's a direct call out there. So right before the bell rings, fill in the blank. The book of Esther. Anybody want to take a stab at this? It's on the bottom of the first page. Yeah, I grew up the Jewish queen who saved her people. Does anybody else have anything different? The Jewish God who saved his people. And that's what I would leave you with. I'm not trying to take away from what the courage Esther had, but this was about a God who saved his people. And I was trying to play, because it's such a common phrase, the Jewish queen that saved her people. That's fair, but at the end of the day, what I took away from this quarter was this was a Jewish God who saved his people through lots of little providence steps. Yeah, Ian.
I was just kind of thinking about through this whole book how it's kind of amazing that this story and many in the Bible where God uses imperfect people to fulfill his plan. And I know myself, and I'm sure many others, tend to beat themselves up a lot when they fall short of living a righteous life and glorifying God in everything that they do. And these stories are kind of just nourishment and healing in that regard, because you really do see that God's plan is unfolding no matter what. And if you're dwelling with him and trying to walk with him, he'll unfold that plan in ways that you can't imagine. And we see that throughout the Bible, and I think if we let that happen in our own lives, we can look back at the end of it and be able to see that too.
Great point. The bell rang. My next three pages are the three P's of providence. We'll get to that another time, another way, but I think Ian capsulized that well, and that God takes care of his people despite our own failures. So thank you for your attention this quarter. I think we're on to Ezekiel from here on out, so...